Yeah.
My name is Bhakti Chaitanya Swami. our topic today, I don't know if you heard, our topic for today is why I became a monk. How does that sound? That's interesting. I'll explain why I became a monk. I don't know if any of you are thinking of becoming monks. But I really started, I'm originally from New Zealand. You heard of New Zealand, right? Long way away. Yeah, I was born and raised in New Zealand. And one of the main reasons, the thing that really moved me to do something like this and to really get into it seriously, full time, I was a student actually. I was a student in university in Auckland, New Zealand. It was a long time ago, more than 40 years ago. And when I was young, even a little younger than yourselves, I was a big Elvis Presley fan. Did you ever hear of Elvis Presley? I was a big Elvis Presley fan. For years, for quite some years. And then you know what happened? Elvis Presley died. And Elvis Presley, I don't know if you know anything about him or what happened to him, but Elvis Presley died in a very, dying in any way is not very nice, I guess, but he died in really like a sad situation, you could say. And because when I was really quite young, like 10, 12, 13, that sort of age, Elvis Presley was big time. He was really, really big time before the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. Elvis Presley ruled. So, but then, Elvis Presley, even though he was so extremely famous, you know, a lot more famous than all of us put together, and he was extremely wealthy, he was just a multi-millionaire, to say the least. But Elvis Presley, he was really not happy, despite all of that. He was really not happy. And what happened to Elvis Presley was eventually, he got so kind of frustrated, and he just wasn't happy, couldn't find happiness. So what Elvis Presley did, listen to this. All he could do, what he turned to, he didn't turn to liquor. He didn't turn to drugs or something, you know, like what some people may do if they become distressed and really frustrated. Elvis Presley turned to eating. Eating. Just, you know, because, well, I mean, everybody likes eating. It's nice. But that was all he could get happiness out of. So as a result, Elvis Presley, from being like, in his day at least, the ultimate sex symbol, really, in a big way, he became like this big fat bubble. And he just lost it. He just really lost it. And eventually, it's a bit of a long story, but eventually what happened to him was, along with eating, he got into some types of drugs to some degree. And Elvis Presley died, maybe in his 40s or not more than 50, I forget actually, his age. He died sitting on a toilet. Would you believe? What a way to go. So it's sad. It's really sad. It's really sad. Like I said, I was a big Elvis Presley fan in my day. And then this happened to him. And I thought, wow. How could it happen to someone like him? Who's so famous and so wealthy, and he had such a massive following. Even today he has a huge following. But look what happened to him. You could consider more in your age group, maybe to some extent. See what happened to Michael Jackson. It was also really sad. Really sad. These people, they're very intelligent. They're very talented. They've really got some charisma. But they just can't keep it together. Despite even Michael Jackson being fantastically wealthy. Now, I'm sure he could have bought the university if he'd wanted to. But it just got too much. It just got too much. So anyway, when Elvis Presley died, it really made me think. I was studying philosophy in Auckland University. And I was brought up as a sort of a Christian, as many white people are. To be quite frank, just sort of a Christian, kind of an official Christian, but I wasn't really very interested, or I didn't really take it very seriously. At least I was educated from the beginning, from the day I turned 5 till the time I got what in New Zealand is the equivalent of matric. More or less, it's called university entrance. So, till the time I got my university entrance, I was educated in the same school, which was an Anglican school, private school, and we would go to church every day, 5 days a week. And plus, we would have religious classes like 2 or 3 days a week for years and years. And, I was into philosophy. I was into trying to understand life and me and things, how things work. And, very kind of questioning type of mind. And I used to give our priest, who would give the classes in the school, I used to ask him difficult questions, and he would get really upset with me. Generally, and I know it's the same here in UJ. Generally, people, students think, right, I'm going to get a good degree. What are you studying? Or are you beyond studying?
I'm a student.
Huh?
I'm still a student.
What are you studying?
Management service.
Management service. And what are you studying?
Sports communications.
Okay. So people study whatever, something. And the idea generally is, we'll get a qualification, get a degree, and then we can get a good job, and then we can get lots of money, and then we can get a big house, and then we get a big car, and etc., etc. Many people are quite focused. Many people in universities are quite focused in these types of terms. And I was studying there at the university. I mean, I thought somewhat differently, but to some degree also I was like that. And here now is my hero, my big super duper hero, Elvis himself. You know, sure, I've bought all his records, seen all his movies. I was into it. And then he died in this pathetic way. Really, just pathetic. And I was already questioning many things in life. But then this happened and I thought, hey, wait a minute. Why are we doing all of this? Where, you know, it's very likely that at best we could achieve a fraction of what he achieved in terms of becoming a famous management expert, the next Stephen Covey, maybe, management guru, or the next big sports expert, and becoming famous and earning, you know, we could probably become a fraction of what he was, but he was not happy with it. And so I was really thinking, why? Is this the best we can do? Can we do more? Can we find real satisfaction? And then, what sort of, maybe topped it off, you could say, or at least an important consideration was that as I got a little older into my teens and maybe 16, 17, 18, like that, then the Beatles arrived, and then the Rolling Stones arrived, and I saw the Rolling Stones live in 1965 in New Zealand. And right at that time they released a song. I don't know how much you're up with these things. I know it's all from the past. But they released a very, very popular song, "I Can't Get No Satisfaction." Did you ever hear that? It was just top of the pops for weeks. "I Can't Get No Satisfaction." And I tried, and I tried, and I tried, but I just can't get no satisfaction. I can remember the whole thing to this day. So then, yeah, it was, these things inspired me in, I would say, like a negative way, that taking this route, just judging by some of these people who are super successful on this route, but it seems it doesn't really work, it doesn't really deliver what we're looking for. So, like I said, I was a philosopher, and then one day, it was actually in April 1972, where were you in April 1972? Elsewhere. We would say, you know what we would say? We would say, you were in your previous lifetimes. That's what we'd say. Anyway, that's another subject for another day. But there I was, April 72, at Auckland University in New Zealand, student of philosophy. And I just walked out of a tutorial, an early morning tutorial. It was maybe 10 in the morning. And I don't know if any of you have heard the singing we do. Have any of you heard that? A little bit? With musical instruments and sort of like, not exactly bells, but the sound is a little bit like bells. I heard the sound coming from on my right-hand side, maybe like 20 meters away, like little bells ringing. That was what I thought. And I looked across. What's going on here? And who should I see but the person who was the leader of our, you know, this Bhakti Yoga Society, the leader of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. His name was Prabhupada. He brought the tradition, Bhakti Yoga, from India. Brought it to America in 1965. This was now 1972 in New Zealand. So he came to the university. I turned around. There he was, walking towards me with a group of other people like myself, you know, monks. And there were some girls there, young women, who you could say were like our version of nuns, something like that. And they're walking towards me, and they walked right past me. Prabhupada, the spiritual master, walked right past me. We were right by the main quadrangle in the middle of the university. Walked right past me. Then I saw just a few meters away was a little stage in the middle of the quadrangle. They sat there, and then they sang, and Prabhupada himself gave a lecture. And he talked basically about these things, talking about God, religion, and our relationship with God. You know, stuff I had heard, really heard a lot about. Plenty. Just heard tons about, particularly at school. You know, my parents, they were not into religion. So we would only go to church if there was a wedding or a funeral, but mainly just weddings. So it was really just at school, you know. I got exposed to it all a lot. So that now here was Prabhupada sitting on this little stage in the middle of the quadrangle, explaining about the same things, basically the same subject matters. But what really struck me as a student of philosophy and someone who used to really think about these things and even worry about these things was that Prabhupada was addressing these subjects very philosophically, and not just from the point of view that you must believe this and have faith in that, this sort of idea. And it struck me. It really struck me. Hey, this is interesting. All these things which I've heard so much about for years, but I just couldn't really get solid, satisfying answers. But here now, he's presenting these things very philosophically with different arguments to establish points, and very rational. And I thought, wow, this is really quite something. And studying philosophy, I was studying all the Western philosophers. I don't know if any of you study philosophy, but well, just the famous Western philosophers, Bertrand Russell. I don't know if you ever heard of Bertrand Russell. He was a very famous British philosopher of like 100 years, 120 years ago or so. He was a very clever man, and he was famous, among other things, he was very famous for having a smoking habit and trying to give it up, but going back to it. And he was a popular personality. In those days, 100 years ago, people like philosophers actually became popular, like personalities. And he was famous for, among other things, he was interviewed once, and the interviewer said, "Mr. Russell, we hear that you've tried giving up smoking. Have you got any advice for the audience, how to give up smoking?" And Bertrand Russell said, "It's easy to give up smoking. I've done it many times." Anyway, so I was studying people like that. And I was studying one, I think it was Wittgenstein, a German philosopher, who was very sharp. You know, these people are sharp. They are very, very sharp in arguing and defeating arguments. So Wittgenstein, he developed the philosophy, it's called the philosophy of the doubt. And basically it means you just doubt everything. And you don't just, you're not like a simple person who just accepts what the advertisements say and what the politicians say and even what the scientists say. You got to doubt them. You got to really question it and go into it and really see. So I thought this was quite good. I thought it was very good, actually, in principle. Until, as we are studying Wittgenstein, we came to the point that Wittgenstein, he became very popular, almost like a pop star sort of status. And he got a whole following. And then I found that Wittgenstein, at one point, he announced to all his followers that, thank you for following me and buying my books, but you're all fools. You're all fools because I doubt my own philosophy. And I thought, hey, wait a minute. Now, I'm studying these guys, but not only him, but Bertrand Russell also, and whoever the others were, they have no real conclusion. They're very clever in certain ways, but they have no real conclusion in terms of life, what to do with your life, and how to live your life, and what's the goal of life, if there is there a goal. But here was Prabhupada now. I attended that lecture, then afterwards some of my friends got involved and I got some books and I read the books and I discussed with a few of my friends who got involved, and I found that this is very satisfying intellectually, because there are good answers, logical answers. And it goes beyond just logic and, like sophism, you could say, just arguing. But actually it gives, it's apparently offering some quite clear idea of what is the goal of life. Why are we actually here? Normally people don't even bother thinking about things like that. beyond just, you know, we've got to make money and be successful and be happy. But, you know, I was one of those types of people who was asking these types of questions, and sometimes some of my friends would get tired of me asking these questions and tell me to be quiet. So I became quite convinced on the level of the philosophy, the arguments, the logic of it, you know, how, interesting thing, how it, Bhakti Yoga analyzes everyday life, what's going on out in the streets of Johannesburg or Auckland or anywhere. What's going on? How is it working? How is it working? And this philosophy, it was not like a new philosophy that Prabhupada himself had come up with, but the philosophy was something extremely ancient. At least that's what they said, like 5,000 years old. But that perspective on life, everyday life, that 5,000 year old philosophy of life, I saw that it's making many points which are simply objectively accurate, not like beliefs. Like, for example, that in ordinary life, just day-to-day life, working and living and, you know, maybe getting married and all these types of things, the philosophy of Bhakti Yoga explains, it states that people do not become really happy, really satisfied with that. They get some stimulation, and like when you smoke a cigarette, you get some stimulation. But who has really become satisfied by smoking cigarettes? I don't know if any of you are into it, or if you know people who are like committed smokers. But, you know, frankly, I mean, I've known many over the years. But you actually don't find people who will really stand up and say, I have solved my problems in life. I am satisfied by the grace of Mr. Rothman. You know, it doesn't happen. People get a bit of a buzz, a bit of a lift, and then it goes, and then they have to smoke another one. So I found it very interesting that these very ancient ideas were not out of date, that they were very real, and it wasn't a question of believing or having faith, but it was just describing reality in little deeper terms, more thoughtful terms. Yeah, like people who are committed, serious, dedicated drinkers. You know, I mean, every day they go for it. You know, you don't find people who are living like that. You know, maybe people who have a little drink every now and then, they may say, well, that's nice. But people who are into it and taking it to the maximum, you just don't find people like that, who, if you observe their life and just look at what their life really is, that you can see this person has achieved real happiness and satisfaction and made a success of his life through being a serious drinker. And the Bhakti Yoga, the philosophy of Bhakti Yoga from the 5,000 year old scriptures, it presents these things, but then it also presents why it doesn't work well, why it didn't work for Elvis Presley and people like that, why it doesn't work well. And here, this is now a little more, you know, like subtle, at least you could say, in that in Bhakti Yoga, the explanation of who we are, what we are, what our natures really are, is that we are all eternal spiritual persons. And these bodies which we are inhabiting right now, they're like vehicles. And these bodies, they have attractions, they have needs, and they have, there's certain things which give them, you know, some pleasure, like eating, like smoking, they give some pleasure. But we actually, the reason why we don't get like real satisfaction, meaning ongoing, indefinite satisfaction, is because we are not material. These bodies are material. They get some stimulation from some of these things, but we are not. Therefore, for us, even if you really make it in a big way in those worldly terms, like Elvis Presley, but it doesn't give you what you're looking for. Even it doesn't give you what you need. And as a result, someone who's got hundreds of millions or billions is actually in sort of objective, analyzable terms, no happier, and maybe even in some cases less happy than someone who's living a very simple existence. So that, of course, like I said, it's a little more subtle to objectively verify that this is why it doesn't work. You know, we now go into the area of faith and like that. But the fact that it's not working as we would really like it to work, well, that can be seen. Any normal person who thinks a little can just see that it's not working the way people would really like it to work. People are not actually becoming satisfied. So then I thought, okay, you know, that's really interesting. Really interesting. Some of it, it's clear what it's saying about life in this world. At least a lot of it, it's clear. It's accurate. Other things are more subtle. There's some element of faith in it. But, you know, let's face it, in life, ordinary everyday life, the element of faith is there in the life of everyone, even, and I'm not meaning in religious terms at all. I'm not meaning in religious terms at all, necessarily. But like when you get your management degree, and now you get your big job as a big manager. So, you know, you'll notice one thing. Maybe you'll notice many things, but I'll tell you one thing you'll notice if you think about it. They never pay you for that a month's work at the beginning of the month, before you did the month's work. They only pay you at the end of the month. And now you have to work for the whole month on the basis of faith that they're going to pay you. They usually do, but sometimes they don't. Yeah, sometimes the firm goes bankrupt, or I go to Russia quite a lot. I actually just got a visa, new one-year multiple entry visa for Russia yesterday. And when I've been going there for many years, since like the very late communist times, and when the whole Russian society went from communist and switched over to capitalist, it wasn't just like you woke up the next morning and there was a capitalist society by any means. There's a whole year, a number of years of transition. And many of the state enterprises went bankrupt. Or if not bankrupt, they kept on functioning, but they couldn't pay the people. And people worked for months without being paid. Sometimes in some of the factories, they give them some of the stuff that they were making in the factory and say, you know, go and sell it and make some money in that way. But I'm just saying, when you work, I think they practically never pay you at the beginning of the month and say, okay, now you please work for the month, because they don't have faith in you. But you work having faith in them that they'll pay you. And this is a pretty universal principle, I would say. And it's an act of faith. You are having faith that you will be paid. So I thought about it, that okay, these points like about how we're eternal spiritual persons, I never saw the eternal being. I never saw it. I never saw a picture of it. And now accepting it, it's an act of faith. But we have faith in many things. So, you know, the rest of it sounds really good. Let me give it a try. So I gave it a try, an initial try, before I really committed to becoming a monk. Then I got into some of the, like, bhakti yoga practices, the spiritual practices. Like there's a process of meditation which we do, which I've been doing since 1973. I've been doing every day the chanting of different mantras. Are you familiar with this term mantra? It's a Sanskrit term, Sanskrit language, which comes from India, or not just India, but Southeast Asia. And mantra, man means mind, the mind, and tra means to deliver. So mantra means a sound vibration which delivers the mind from its entanglement in all the things that go on in our life, and particularly the anxieties. Am I going to pass the test or not? The exam. Will I fail? Anxieties. Have any of you ever experienced any anxiety at university? A little bit? Huh? A lot of it. So for those of you who haven't, you can ask her. She can tell you about it. Anyway, I know you've all experienced some anxiety. So mantra means a spiritual sound vibration which delivers your mind from being caught up in those things and takes your mind to a higher level where It's not influenced by the anxieties and emotional problems and things like that. Which is, you know, it's really good. It's really nice. So this is what they told me. And so I tried it. I gave it a try. And I found, hey, it works. Wow, this is interesting. And it's not like I'm believing in it. I'm just trying it and having a go and seeing what happens. And then this happens. And a number of other people, because I was getting involved in sort of the yoga scene. So I met a number of other people and we discussed these things. And they had exactly the same experience. And to sort of fast forward a little bit, by the time I was a monk, and in fact I had been a monk for some years and you know, committed to this, I spent some time with another very famous entertainer, George Harrison from the Beatles. Did you ever hear of the Beatles? Did you ever hear of George Harrison? I'm waiting. You know, I mean, in general, in my life, I'm waiting till I meet a person who if I ever ask, which I occasionally do, have you ever heard of the Beatles? I'm waiting for someone to say, who? But even now, many years later, people have heard of them. So anyway, George Harrison, who, you know, unfortunately he passed away some years ago, but he was really into these things, very deeply into yoga, meditation, very deeply. And I, you know, I met him a number of times, and then one day I visited him in his house, in his place, and we were talking about how he got into the meditation and this whole field of things. And particularly, well, there are many mantras, many of these spiritual sound vibrations which have these pleasant effects. But the main mantra, the main one, it's called actually the Maha Mantra, which means the great mantra, is what's known in the West as the Hare Krishna Mantra. Have you heard of the Hare Krishna Mantra? Yeah? Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So he was very into it. Really very, very into it. This was the end of 79. So we were talking about how he got into it. And he told me, and it's a long story, but he told me that he, in the late 60s, like maybe 68, 60, something like that, the end of the Beatles, he and John Lennon were on a boat cruise in the Mediterranean. They'd been to India a few times, and they were into yoga, meditation, mantras. You know, they're very interested in it, and practicing to some degree. So George said that one day, he and John Lennon woke up early, by their standards, 7 o'clock. And somehow one of them said, hey, let's chant Hare Krishna. And the other one said, yeah, right, okay. So they picked up their guitars and they started playing their guitars and singing this Hare Krishna mantra, which I just mentioned. And they got into it. And they, now they're really playing their guitars and they're really singing, they're really into it. And that was 7 o'clock in the morning. 9 o'clock came, 2 hours, And someone came and said, it's breakfast time, you must have some breakfast. They just carried on. They didn't stop. Then 1 o'clock in the afternoon came, 6 hours later. And someone came and said, listen, you didn't have any breakfast, you must have some lunch. They carried on. They just carried on. In the evening, time for supper, they carried on. Seriously. George explained, they carried on, would you believe, till 5 o'clock the next morning. 22 hours with just, you know, a few toilet breaks in between. They didn't eat. Nothing. And George said it was a very powerful experience. Very powerful experience of freedom from anxiety and very rich feeling of happiness and satisfaction for hours and hours. It was just an amazing experience. And he said, this is what convinced me, my own experience. And, you know, I had also been a Beatles fan, been there, done that. And I asked George, what would it have been like if you sang one of your Beatles songs for 22 hours? And in fact, I mentioned a particular, extremely popular Beatles song from my youth. Did you ever hear the song, I Want to Hold Your Hand? Did you hear that? I mean, you never heard that. You wasted 20% of your life. Not really. So, but it was hugely popular when I was, I think, 13 years old, 1964. Massively popular. So I asked George, what would it have been like if you had sung for 22 hours straight, I Want to Hold Your Hand? And he laughed. And he thought, you know, for a few seconds. And then he referred to another Beatles song, which again you may not have heard of, but it was also extremely popular. He said, well, I think it would have been a hard day's night. Are you familiar with that? It's been a hard day's night. I've been working like a dog. And it goes on. I can also remember that. It would have been tough. Because it's material sound vibration. You know, I'm sorry to say, although I'm kind of happy to say, I'm really out of touch with the popular music scene. And I would imagine you'd all be up to date. And I'm sure there's someone who's extremely popular and everyone's just like into them. I heard, who's coming? There's some famous singer coming. What's his name? Chris Brown? Chris Brown? Anyway, that's okay. But they're out there. And people are into them. Yeah. But, and George, who, you know, was popular like Elvis Presley, just extra dimensional popularity, he told me that, and I mean he told plenty of people at different times, that when he was so popular, and making millions. And they had girls. If girls would see them, if they walked through the university, the girls would scream and chase them. Yeah. And grab them. And pull their hair out. Seriously. and pull their clothes off in public. No joking at all. But he told me it was just the worst time of my life. And he said, when the Beatles broke up, I just breathed a sigh of relief. That was an interesting experience also for me. So anyway, like I say, I became a monk. It was 73. Because I felt convinced intellectually, which was important for me because I really tried to think about things. But I'd also had some tangible experience through the chanting of mantra and some other things also, but let's just say chanting of mantra for the time being. And, you know, here's an interesting fact if you're into facts, figures, and statistics. If you're a sort of actuarial scientist type, maybe. I, just myself, truly, I have been chanting different mantras, but particularly the Hare Krishna mantra, more than anything, more than the others. I've been doing this since 1973, every day, and I mean 365 days and 366 of leap years, for at least a couple of hours a day. Really, really. And more, sometimes more. But I can tell you, truly, it's extremely satisfying. It's really, really nice. And I really recommend it for people, anybody, to try. Just try and see what happens. So I've been doing that now. It's 42 years. 42 years. And actually, it gets better all the time. And I don't think, I hope, but I don't think I'm like brainwashed robot, something like that. I don't think I am. Yeah. So, but that's why I became a monk and then I got into it, and I'm into it. I'm really into it. Now, having said that, I'm not sitting here saying all these things. My idea basically is just to inform, educate, that's all. I'm not trying to sort of, you know, browbeat anyone, push them into getting into something. Not like that. But it's a fact that you don't actually have to become a monk like me, or say like a nun if you're a woman, to get into it, to really get into it and really get a lot out of it. You don't have to do that. In fact, the main literature of Bhakti Yoga from 5,000 years ago, called Bhagavad Gita, we may have some copies around. So the Bhagavad Gita is spoken by Krishna here's Bhagavad Gita. The whole thing is Sanskrit and then translated into English and word for word, translated word for word into English. So the not exactly original Bhakti Yogi, but a very prominent one in the tradition from 5,000 years ago, very, very prominent one, who Bhagavad Gita was spoken to and who then became a very prominent bhakti yogi. He never became a monk. He was actually, you may be quite surprised to hear, he was a warrior. He was a warrior. He was a big, powerful man. Really big and really powerful. And he would fight face to face, not from a distance, you know, fire a rifle or something like that, but face to face, hand to hand. That was his profession. And he was a married man with a family. So if someone like that can do it, then a management expert can do it too. Why not? Or a sports expert can do it too. In other words, this is something very universal. It's not just narrow, and you must become a monk. If you don't become a monk, then, you know, you're out of it. It's not like that at all. It's something very universal, which anyone can apply in terms of their occupational life, their work. If they're married, they have a family, in terms of their family situation. Something very universal, very practical. Yeah. And really nice. Really nice. So that's what I've got to say, I think, at this point. Except, are there some questions there? Did anyone write any questions? Yeah, let's just have a look at the questions.
This is not a question.
Huh? Okay, we've got 5 questions. Let's just have a look here. Wow. The first question. Sorry? No, I can read them. No, I'm just saying. What a question. How's this? What is life? That's not a question. I don't know what is. And what is the end of life? Okay. Let's just give a brief idea. I mean, obviously this is a big subject. What is life? Well, I mentioned already, and it's coming from Bhagavad Gita, that's where it's coming from, this idea that we're all eternal spiritual persons. And the body, of course, is temporary, but we live on. We live on. The body, after all, you know, I don't think you study medicine here, or I don't know if any of you study any biology or any that sort of science. But if you do, you would know that these bodies can be quite easily analyzed in chemical terms. Chemical, like water, H2O, you follow that? 2 parts hydrogen, 1 part oxygen. And our bodies, I was told when I was at school in New Zealand, our bodies are, if I remember correctly, 70% water. Is it the same in South Africa? So, you know, and it's water, means water, not some, you know, special, super special something they're calling water. It means water, H2O, and it's 70% or so of our body. Then our bones are mainly calcium, and as you get older, you may start getting, you know, your bones may start sort of breaking down, what's that called? Osteoporosis. Then you have to start taking calcium pills. Yeah. To try and fortify, strengthen the calcium. And it's calcium. And there are various other chemicals. Our bodies can be analyzed in chemical terms. And, you know, 70% water. But did you, if you collect all the chemicals together and put them on the table here, enough to make a body, are any of those chemicals conscious? Ask the water. Anyway. When I was living in England for some time, and I saw in one of the main newspapers in London years ago in the 70s, that our bodies, the chemicals which make up our bodies, you can buy them in a chemical shop, and if you want to buy enough for, you know, it would be what's in a typical body in those days, it would cost, it was plus or minus 10 pounds. Yeah. Plus or minus 10 pounds. But here we are, you know, and we are conscious. We are conscious. Not just conscious like aware, but we have dynamic consciousness. We have intelligence. We can analyze, we can think, and look at things from different perspectives and evaluate things. You never saw a bottle of water do that. Not even Valpran. So where is the consciousness, the life coming from? The bottle of water, the water is not alive. Our bodies are alive. Where is the life coming from? And why? Well, the person asked, what is the end of life? Why is it that these bodies die? Because when the body dies, the brain is still there, the heart is still there, all the chemicals, it's all still there. But the life is not there, and the consciousness is not there. Why? Well, Bhagavad Gita, the answer given by Bhagavad Gita is that because the life, the consciousness, is not a product of chemicals. Life is another thing. It's a different thing. Like, if you have a watch, generally nowadays the watches run on batteries. You take the battery out of the watch stops. So the battery is the source of sort of life, or energy at least, for the watch. So, according to Bhagavad Gita, Krishna and Bhagavad Gita, there is something living, something which is like intrinsically living and conscious within the body, which is otherwise just a combination of material elements, just a material object like the table, which is also not conscious. And when that thing, the spiritual person, or we adopt the word soul, we adopt the word soul from the English vocabulary. So when the soul, the eternal conscious person, leaves the material body, that is called death. It's exited, and now there's no more life. There's no more consciousness. That body which previously, if you took like a knife or a razor blade or something, and you just made, you know, a relatively small cut, a few centimeters, a relatively small cut, the person would scream. But now you can smash the body and there's no reaction whatsoever. Because the conscious being is no longer there, has exited and gone elsewhere. So life is going on like that. And because the conscious living being or the soul is eternal, no beginning and no end, but the bodies, they have beginnings and ends. So when the body is finished, the eternal soul can't just sort of go nowhere, but goes into another body, which is just suitable for you in terms of the condition you were in, like psychologically, and the type of person you were in the later part of your life and the time of death. So that's what life is. And the goal of life, we could say, the goal of life is to reawaken our forgotten relationship with the Supreme Soul, or in English, God, who we have an eternal personal relationship with. Let's see. Wow, okay, here's another one. Esoteric. Last week's speaker mentioned a chakra. I am not clear on what is a chakra. Well, a chakra is, at certain points in the body, energy is focused. Energy, of course, is distributed from our toes to the top of our head. But energy is focused more particularly in certain parts of the body. Those places where the energy is more focused, even though it's there in the other parts, but it's more focused, they're called chakras. And in certain types of yoga, Kundalini yoga, which, generally people have not heard of, but what they try to do is lift the energy, those energy centers, lift them all up to the head. And the idea is when a person does that, they get a certain type of enlightenment. Certain type of enlightenment. Because all that vital energy, life energy, has now been focused in the head. How does that sound? That's a basic idea. Let's see. What is your take or the belief on the belief that thoughts are emotions, or thoughts and emotions create your reality? You know, really, we wouldn't say they create your reality like this room. But they may create your reality in terms of the sort of the bubble of consciousness that you live in. Your bubble of consciousness means how you see yourself and how you see life. Your attitudes like that. So certainly your thoughts and emotions, they form your, sort of your existential reality, your personal sense of being and sense of who you are, what your life's about, and all like that. And your plans in life, your direction in life, these things kind of evolve from that little bubble, your personal bubble of consciousness. Let's see. Are your physical features applying to your spiritual being? Like your hair, the way it's cut, as well as the way you dress? That's a very interesting question. We're all spiritual persons, that's the idea. And when we say persons, we mean real persons. Not just like spiritual things, but persons with personalities, spiritual forms, spiritual desires, spiritual minds, spiritual emotions, spiritual intelligence, a real person, but spiritual. Spiritual means much higher, not restricted by having a gross material body and, you know, being very attached to the body and seeing yourself in terms of the body, like I'm a man or you're a woman and so on. So your physical features are more, though, connected with your psychological and emotional being. In Bhagavad Gita, and there are other literatures, in Bhakti Yoga, we don't just have one book. There's a whole body of literatures. They're called the Vedic literatures. And particularly in other of the Vedic literatures, there's a description that as we have this physical body of flesh and blood and or water and calcium like that, so we also have a mental body, a mental psychological, we call it the subtle body, because you don't see it, you can't really see mind, you can't really see intelligence. You can see them working, but you can't actually see them. So it's a subtle body. And based on the condition of your subtle body, or, you know, in simple terms, on the basis of your psychological condition and your emotional condition, then you'll dress in this way or that way. You have long straight hair. She has her hair up. Right? And you're dressed in one way, she's dressed in another way. And people have different tastes in food, in music, in motor cars, different taste in friends. It's all coming from your psychological and emotional condition. And Bhagavad Gita, one point which is made very vividly in Bhagavad Gita, is that, like I mentioned, going into another body, the eternal conscious person, going into another body when this body dies. So, the idea really is, depending on the state of your subtle body, your psychological condition, you will get a next body which just fits in with that. Just right. So that when you are now born in that body and you're now developing, growing up a little, you feel completely at home in this body. Like, this is me. This is me. Because it has been custom tailored to fit into your psychological condition. Yeah. So, you know, sometimes you get people where their psychological condition, emotional condition, they're like misfits within their body. Is a big subject nowadays, transgender. I don't know how big it is here, but like in America and Europe, big, very big subject. And more people are coming forward and saying, you know, I want to be whatever the opposite sex is. I feel myself to be like that. You follow me, right? Yeah. So, you may get some sort of people who have mixed nature, like mixed male and female nature. That's not so. I mean, everybody has some mixture of male and female nature to some degree. So those are some thoughts on that subject. And here we go, last question. What moves life? You know, I think we covered that. Really, the soul moves life, because the soul is conscious and has life. Yes, sir.
I would like to elaborate further on that. Like, what moves
the last life? One.
Yeah, the last one.
Okay.
Like, this is where you say we are the subject body. What imparts intellect into the subject body? What forms?
No, it's composed of it.
It's composed of it.
It's a body made of the substance called mind. Just as there is a substance called water, there is a substance called mind. It's a material thing. And the consciousness of the eternal spiritual person is transmitted through the mind and then into the body. So the body acts in terms of how the mind thinks.
So you mentioned that the spirit can at a later stage transform to another body or
not transform, but just go into like you change your motor car.
Okay. Right. So that literally means that is like time traveling. At the later stage you will this, and then at the later stage you become dead. So will you be able to be like keep track of time, if maybe you're somewhere in the Himalaya mountain or somewhere in the cave, and really know how many days or how many months or years have passed without even looking at the time? Or can your energy vibrate to the...
You know, I mentioned a little while ago that now in this condition, our consciousness is very limited. As a person becomes more spiritually developed, then their consciousness develops, and for example, they become able to remember previous lifetimes. You know, time travel in the sense of H.G. Wells, I don't know if you've heard of H.G. Wells, The Time Machine, and some of the recent movies where people have been traveling in time. It's not such a big thing. No, we're already traveling in time. Since we've been here, we've traveled in time for about 45 minutes. But as a person becomes spiritually developed, then their consciousness becomes broader. And for example, they can remember previous lifetimes. You occasionally get people who can remember previous lifetimes. At least that's what we hear. But as a person really becomes spiritually developed, they may be able to remember all their lifetimes. I'm not really exactly addressing your question, but
I'm not talking about like the physical time travel, like moving towards like time, like say now 45 minutes, is talking about like when you spiritually enlightenment, when you're in full enlightenment, all your chi in your body is connected and you can see multiple dimensions in life, like move out of one's body and
that's possible
to another dimensions and life forms.
That's possible.
So as a monk, are you able to do that when you maybe
no. But it's possible. I mean, not that for people who are very, very advanced, it may be possible. You know, most of them, people who are very advanced, they wouldn't really bother about things like that. They wouldn't really worry, because they're really more interested in developing their spiritual nature and developing their personal relationship with God. Because that's more interesting, it's nicer, it's more enjoyable, much more enjoyable. Yeah. Anyway, think about it. Anyone else have a comment or a question? You know what I heard? Hang on a sec. Let me tell you what I heard. I heard that at UJ, I heard the students are very intelligent and very thoughtful. That's what I heard. That's what I was told. And I heard they have many questions and inquiring minds. So if there's anything anyone would like to raise now, right at the end, feel free. If not, it's okay. Yes?
I've heard a story, a love story, whereby this child who's 7, right, they say he's 10 to 7, he was 2 years old back then, and he lived a life before as a girl, and then he came back as a boy. So he actually, he was 3 years, and he was telling his mom how she used to be before. And she was saying they were watching a movie, and then she's like, oh, like the car was bombing, there was a fire. She's like, oh man, this movie reminds me of how I died. And then the mom is like, how did you die? Right. And the boy is like, I was a girl, and when I was sleeping, there was a fire. And I went upstairs because the fire was actually at the ground floor. Uh-huh. So everyone was rushing upstairs. And when I got upstairs, the car was failing, and I jumped downstairs. The boy told the mom the building name went off the fire. So it happened around 1996, somewhere there. So the mom went to the internet and searched for that building and everything. And the building was there, and the building was on fire. And one of the ladies who were recognized is the lady who the boy says he was. So they took the guy to the show, the boy to the show. So they kept on showing him the pictures of the girl, and then a picture of the girl was around 7 years old, because the boy passed when he was around day 29. So the girl back then was 7 years old, so they just showed the picture to see if the boy was really that girl. And then all of a sudden that boy was like, oh, this is me, I was 7 years old, I did this and this, here it was cool. And he talked a lot. He was only 2 years old when he mentioned things like God, that when I passed on, I will live with God, and God told me that I'm going to come back. And here I was, I'm here as a child. So it really showed me that we live on.
Right. No, that's good. You know, there are actually many cases like that. Similar? Many. And there are books with compilations of the stories of different people who, you know, in terms of this life, there's no way they would know those things. It's just not possible. You know, like there's no internet or anything. But they could remember situations in other countries, on other continents. You know, it's a related thing. It's a related thing. And we take it very seriously. We really don't think this life is the only life, and that's it. And before this life, we didn't exist. And when we die, that's the end. We don't accept that at all. And an interesting... Let me just close by mentioning an interesting little thing. It is a little subtle, but if you think about it, I think you'll find it interesting. Is that in the course of our lives, you know, of course I've lived a lot longer than I guess any of you, but even yourselves, in the course of your lives, your bodies have changed tremendously from the time you were little baby to now. The body's changed tremendously, much bigger. And your mind has changed tremendously from when you were a little child to now. But still, you have a sense, there's a clear sense, I am the same person. I am the same individual. Even though my body has changed tremendously, and my mind has changed so much. And you know, as a baby I couldn't even speak. But now I know like a whole language, or maybe a number of languages. The mind has changed so much. But still we know, I am the same person. I am a person, an entity, who is kind of encircled by the body and the mind. So that person who has not changed, who has been constant, we would say, this is the soul. This is the person, the actual person, who is like the possessor of the body and the mind for the time being. So how are you doing? Should we stop?
No.
One question.
Yeah, let her first, and then, yeah. Go ahead.
Can I say that back to the yoga is just a matter of satisfying the spirit?
Well, it does satisfy the spirit. But it satisfies it by doing certain things, which are the activities of Bhakti Yoga. But yeah, the end result is to get the real satisfaction, which we are looking for. But generally people look for it in the wrong places. Yeah. So Bhakti Yoga basically means the natural activities of the soul. How we naturally live as eternal persons, our natural way of life. And when you live a natural way of life, then, well, it's natural. Everything just flows, and it's really nice. Is that okay? And now, okay.
Since the mind is considered as material,
yeah.
Does it some way connect with spiritual consciousness?
See, it can be spiritualized. Yeah, you can develop a spiritual state of mind. Even the gross body can be sort of spiritualized by engaging it in spiritual activity to some degree. But you can spiritualize your mind by engaging it, like the chanting of mantra, among other things, yeah. And when your mind is fully God conscious, then your mind is fully spiritual. Yeah. And just another interesting little point is that the gross body dies, of course, but your mental body goes on with you to the next gross body. And that's why when you're born in the next body, why you feel at home. Because, you know, your sort of general state of mind, your general condition goes with you into the next body. And then as you start developing in your next body, then you feel, yeah, this is me. Just imagine if you had the mind, say, of a dog, but you had your body. Wow, you know, it wouldn't just be a transgender problem, it's a trans-species problem. Yes, sir, sorry.
So I would like to know the different types of consciousness. Well,
Different types of?
Of monks.
Monks, yes. Okay. Yeah, in our tradition, there really are two main types of monks. One is like a student monk, you could say, younger and learning the things and practicing like that. And one is a more, you know, a more senior, more experienced monk who's become, achieved a certain amount of qualification, at least sort of, you know, like in terms of spiritual academics and spiritual practice. So the student in Sanskrit is called a brahmachari, if male, like this gentleman sitting on your right there. He's a brahmachari. There he is. He's a student, younger man. Or in the case of a woman, is a brahmacharini. And then when someone is more senior, like myself, then they take vows of renunciation, like to never marry, is particularly the main one, and, you know, not to be involved with the opposite sex in that way. So those types of vows are generally only taken when a person's older, like usually only when they're, say, 50. Sometimes maybe between 40 and 50. But otherwise, it's really for older people. Is that okay?
So what's the difference between the Zen Buddhist monk
That's just a different tradition with different understanding of life and different understanding of so many things.
So but the philosophy is almost...
No. You know, in Buddhism in general, not just Zen, but in Buddhism in general, the basic point in their philosophy is, in pure traditional Buddhism, as given by Buddha 2,500 years ago when he lived in India, the basic idea is nothing exists. Nothing exists.
So if nothing exists, that means the unborn is also the undying.
No, it means there is no, there's no even unborn, there's no even undying, there's nothing. There is nothing. Nothing exists.
So that means philosophy is dead if nothing exists.
See, I'm not a Zen Buddhist or a Buddhist, so you can discuss it with them, see what they say.
I just wanted to know the different levels and
types. That's not a term of level now, it's a different school then, you see. It's a different school altogether. Yeah.
So one last question.
Yes, sir. No problem, seriously.
Would you say philosophy is dead?
Dead?
Yes.
No, it's alive.
It's alive.
Yeah. Real philosophy is the basis of life because... it's not even like a, you could say it's an explanation of life, but in a sense, you could say it is a depiction of life. It's depicting reality.
Because I've read some material that said, even you said, like, conclusion, there's no conclusion. They said, in the future, science will too, but because science has tools that will be proving things literally, like how things exist and how they function and all of that, their mechanism.
You know what we say to the scientists? We say, good luck. Really. Because the more they discover, the more they see there's more to discover. That's what's happening in science.
So it's like an endless path.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's not really like a real solution to the problems of life. It can be a vehicle, something to help us in certain aspects of our life. In Bhakti Yoga, in our organization, We have a scientific wing. It's called the Bhaktivedanta Institute. And they are real scientists. They're not just sort of religious, you know, believing something scientists. They're hard scientists. Hard scientists. The leaders are all PhDs, double PhDs, and even quite famous people in their fields like quantum mechanics. Are you, do you know anything about quantum mechanics?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like big leaders in quantum mechanics. So, yeah, but you know, the thing is this. The thing is this, really. That the idea is to reawaken our spiritual nature. It's already there. It doesn't have to be acquired from an external source. It's already there. It just needs to be reawakened and developed. And in terms of like maintaining yourself, getting a roof over your head, food, you know, you need some occupation. You can sort of do almost anything within reason. Like I mentioned, Bhagavad Gita is spoken to a warrior, like a real serious warrior. And he spiritualized his life as a warrior. So whether you're a management person or a, you know, just whatever, it almost doesn't matter. There's certain things we wouldn't advise people to do. But otherwise, in general, like what you're doing, go for it. But don't just focus your whole life on that. It's a way of making a living to maintain yourself. Fine. You've got to maintain yourself. You should work to live, but not live to work. And then spiritualize your life. The vast majority, I mean more than 90% of people in South Africa who practice Bhakti Yoga, they're not monks. They're just regular people. See her just behind you. There. She is a graduate from here. She's a graduate from here. And she is, tell him what you do. She's a homeopathic doctor. She has a homeopathic practice. She's a doctor. Yeah. And he's a radiographer. Also from here. From right here. And he's working in what's the hospital? Huh? Sunning Hill Hospital, x-raying people. But he's a, you know, serious practitioner of Bhakti Yoga. And she's a very serious practitioner.
You mentioned that.
The last question.
you say, Buddhist monks say, like, there's nothing exists.
Yes.
Other than ancient Greek philosophers and all those Western philosophers, like, they were in their time, like, they couldn't identify what color is the sky, like, blue, like, you see this plane is blue, like, they did not have the word blue to describe what the color of the sky is until recently. Some philosopher did an investigation or a research into the ancient tribes of Africa, like, asking them what is like with multiple colors and
how to describe with words.
And there was no word to describe the color blue except.
See, the thing is, you know, I'm sorry to cut you off, but I studied, and I actually can't even remember who it was, because it was the early 1970s, but somebody. And he said that when you really get into it, even the statement, I exist, becomes extremely complex. So my response basically to your point and principle would be that you're overcomplicating things unnecessarily. There's no real need to get into things like that. You do something to maintain yourself, something you have some ability at, something you enjoy doing, and develop your spiritual life. And don't worry about the Buddhists.
What I was going to say is, how do you know of their knowings and how do you not know of their unknowns?
Yeah. Because people who know these things have told us. Yeah. Okay. Last.
So how do you develop your spiritual life?
Okay. Good, thank you. Yeah, well, I mentioned mantras, chanting mantras. Like I said, I do it every day, and he does every day also, and she does every day for a couple of hours. I mean, you don't have to do it for a couple of hours, but start doing it. Study the literatures. Learn these things. Start learning these things. Attend the programs. We have programs going on, like this program. And we have program at VITS. We have a program at different places. We have programs in different areas around Joburg, around Pretoria. Get involved. Attend the programs. And sort of like one of the basic activities or types of activities that we do different things which are services. We do them as services to God. Like what I'm doing, you're here as a student, you know, you find it interesting perhaps. I'm doing this, I'm speaking to you as a service to God. This is one of my main services. For years and years, speaking to people about these things.
So, do you like at some times get an opportunity to speak to God in one-on-one conversation when you speak and you don't
talk to Him? You know, I don't want to say to you that God talks to me like I'm talking to you and you're talking to me, because I don't want to cheapen it. Yeah, but. But definitely we can speak with God. And as a person progresses, or even in the earlier stages, they find that God is interacting with them in their lives. Different things are happening. Not just speaking, but actual events. Some events are taking place. And one can understand, this is the hand of the Lord. It's not just, you know, happening.
You mentioned something about your spiritual life, like, comes into to it connects with God. Like,
yeah.
There's a level where you have reached that maturity of the spirit.
You see, ultimately you enter into your personal eternal relationship with God. Each of us already has an eternal relationship with God. We would say you were previously in it, but somehow you got out of it, and now you've forgotten about it, and now you can revive it, and He will interact with you, and in due course you'll develop a personal, fully personal, face-to-face, actual relationship with Him. And at the end of this life, you will return to the kingdom of God and you'll live there with Him, face to face, in a personal, loving relationship. What do you think of that?
Thank you. You mentioned something about we live on. We, our spiritual
life. Oh, we live
lives,
on, yeah.
Right? the body dies, but the spirit lives on.
Right.
So now you're saying that we go and live in the kingdom. Now I'm confused. How do I go about living in the kingdom?
Of God.
Yes.
No, I said when you die, when the body dies, then you, the spiritual person, at the time of death, you will return to the kingdom of God. Yes? Like geographical relocation. Yeah. Yeah. In the meantime, he will interact with you. Yeah. Particularly as you come close to him and, you know, you really progress and develop your relationship. It's nice. It's really nice. Okay, students, thank you very much. Been great being here in your company.